Please turn with me to John 18, beginning in verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas, having procured a band of soldiers and some officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, went there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that would happen to him, came forward and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. So he asked them again, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "Of those whom you gave me, I have lost not one." Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its sheath. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" So here we get to see Jesus operating in his role as the Good Shepherd. Remember before he was talking about the Good Shepherd? Good Shepherd lays down his life for his sheep. The Good Shepherd will be struck and the sheep will be scattered. All this is going on. But even in this moment when he's being arrested, he's looking out for his disciples. Judas comes then in the night, in the darkness. And we've seen this light and darkness through the whole book of John. Judas comes in the darkness and he comes to the garden where Jesus and his disciples were. It seems that Judas would know they were there because this is where they regularly, this was their hotel when they were in Jerusalem. We don't have any record of them ever staying with anybody in a house in Jerusalem. They seem to have stayed out in the open air in this particular garden. So this place would have been known to Judas, and he saw it as a good location to do his evil deed. And Judas comes with armed men and representatives of the Sanhedrin. And the Sanhedrin, of course, is made up of the chief priest and the Pharisees. So there are Sadducees and Pharisees involved in the Sanhedrin. Jesus approaches the men. He didn't wait for them to come all the way to him. He goes toward them and he says, whom do you seek? And of course they say, "Jesus of Nazareth." And he replies, "I am." He uses that the name of God there. "I am." And they're a little startled, I think, by that. So when he stands before them, he's not standing them before merely as a man. He's standing before them as deity. He says, "I am." Very clear indication of who he says he is. He's not fearful. He's not as a person who's afraid or fearing danger and running away. He is in complete control of the situation. They're so startled, they fall back, and he has to ask them again for whom they've come. Now they're a little bit not expecting this. I think they came prepared for battle or a chase, you know, these typical things that you would expect. And they weren't expecting the person they were looking for to come at them all by himself and be demanding information from them, being the one questioning them. Now, how and why they fell back, we don't know. That is not given to us here. But the fact that they did is highlighted by John to demonstrate the presence that Jesus has before them. He has great presence that night. But Jesus doesn't want the disciples arrested. And that's why I think he asks twice, who is the very particular person? Whom are you seeking? Making them declare. Well, the warrant says, you know, making them declare who it is. So they wouldn't round them all up. They had to declare who they were after. And then Jesus says, "Well, you're after me then. Let everybody else go. You're not looking for them." So the good shepherd here is protecting his sheep. And Jesus tells them, this is neat. He's not asking them to let the other guys go. Well, here I am. Please let these other guys go. He's saying, "No, you got me. You're going to let these other people go." He's telling them what to do. It's very interesting to look at the person in the situation he's in. He's calling the shots here. And of course, Peter pulls out his sword. I'm assuming Peter's right-handed for a minute. Pulls out his sword. Normally, if you were facing somebody and you were right-handed, you'd probably go for, you know, this angle, which would be the left ear. I don't know how he managed to get the right ear. I don't know what he was doing. Well, I don't know. You guys are assuming he's left-handed. I'm assuming he's right-handed. I have much more statistics on my side than you do. I'm going more for Peter didn't know what he was doing with that thing. And
come on. Peter probably didn't He hit the guy in the ear. You know, I don't think, I'm going to hit that guy's ear. I'm going to cut that guy's ear. I think he was going for the whole head. But he, terrible shot. Anyway, I'm assuming that. Of course, Jesus rebukes him and heals the ear of the servant. But the point here is very important. There will be no earthly battle. Jesus' kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. I say that and say that and say that again. Jesus' kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. It's not established the way earthly kingdoms are established. It is not extended like earthly kingdoms are extended. We never use the methods of warfare to extend the kingdom of God. We do not defend our king with a sword. Never, ever do we do that. Anyone who does is not following Christ. Rather, Jesus will establish his kingdom, he says, with the cup the Father has given him. Jesus' kingdom is established and extended through sacrificial love for the benefit of others. That is how Jesus' kingdom is established and extended. It is not an earthly kingdom. What's interesting here is there's no prayer in the garden account. Like the other Gospels have Jesus talking about, you know, not my will, but yours be done. That, John leaves that out. John, again, is focusing very particular information toward us to see Jesus in his majesty. And he mentions the cup here, but he doesn't have the prayer things. Jesus is taking the cup willingly. He will be the offering of sacrificial love for all those in his kingdom. Remember that from before? Not only will he preserve his disciples that night, he will forever preserve them through his death. Verse 12, so the band of soldiers and their captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him. First they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had advised the Jews that it would be expedient that one man should die for the people. Jump over to verse 19. The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. When he had said these things, one of the officers standing by struck Jesus with his hand, saying, is that how you answer the high priest? Jesus answered him, if what I said is wrong, bear witness about the wrong. But if what I said is right, why do you strike me? Annas then sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So here we have this scenario with Jesus and Caiaphas. But first he's brought before Annas. Annas is Caiaphas' father-in-law, it tells us here. The way it worked is the Romans had kicked Annas out of the high priesthood. But Annas was still very powerful, and he managed to have his son-in-law be high priest. Five of the other sons were able to be high priest, but I think he was still behind the scenes in the real control. The Jews saw the high priesthood as being for life, and so even if the Romans kicked you out, you still had a lot of control there of what was happening. At least Annas did in this case. John reminds us here of what Caiaphas had said in chapter 11, 49 and 15. Caiaphas had said this, you know nothing at all. Nor do you understand that it's better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. So John, before when he had mentioned this, saw the high priest speaking prophetically about what was going to happen about Jesus. He wants to know, in the questioning, about Jesus' teaching and his disciples, which is very interesting. It seems he might be more concerned about how many disciples Jesus had, and what they might be up to. You know, Jesus isn't the only guy here. They know he's got followers. And so there's the question there revolves around, what have you been teaching? How big a crowd do you have? What are you telling them to do? He's a little nervous about that the group of disciples and what they might be about out this night and the nights to come. And Jesus will not talk about his disciples. He's, again, protecting them. He says, we're not going to go there. All the things I've taught, I've been very open about it. And now that's not to say he didn't teach his disciples privately. He obviously did that. But Jesus wasn't at the temple courts preaching revolution. He never taught that at all. And that's what the gist of what he's answering here. He protests, rather, in the way he's being treated. He's not being treated in a lawful manner. You weren't to strike prisoners. You were not even allowed to question prisoners as to what they had done. You were not, you know, what everything we're doing here. And that's possibly why they go to Annas first and not make it a legal trial before the high priest. Annas is doing this. He knows it's not legal, but maybe he can get some incriminating things out of Jesus. You weren't allowed to ask people to testify against them and just against themselves. You had to first bring in the witnesses against them and have the witnesses say, this is what the person did, before there was any kind of a trial. Without the testimony or two or three witnesses, you had nothing. There were no witnesses there. So Jesus says, well, bring the witnesses in first. You're doing everything wrong. And then, you know, he gets smacked. You weren't supposed to do that either. But that wasn't really an issue here. I mean, everything that's going to happen in the next day toward Jesus is completely wrong and unjust. John wants us to think, though, about the idea of witness. That's been one of his themes through the gospel. Well, the witness of the Father, the witness of Christ, the witness of the miracles. All these witnesses. And what is Jesus saying to them? I've given you witnesses through this whole, through all the teaching that I've done, through my works. The Father's been my witness. Now, where are your witnesses? That's really the question here. If you're going to say anything negative about Jesus, you have to say, what is your witness? What is your proof against Jesus? It comes in the issue of evangelism. When we testify what Jesus has done in our lives, and hopefully there's something he's done in your life. If not, come and see me. We need to talk. But if he's done something in your life, you're a testimony. You're a witness to that to other people. And if they don't like that, then they have to produce their own witnesses of why they think that reality isn't true in your life. Now let's jump back into here. Peter, as Jesus is being transported along, Peter's been following on the sidelines, keeping an eye on Jesus. And now we're going to look at Peter's denial. Very, very famous text, starting verse 15. Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did another disciple. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest, but Peter stood outside at the door. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself. Now, the story tells us here that two disciples followed Jesus. Peter, and many presume it's John, is the other one, and therefore you have this account here from John. And, you know, and they build a case of why John could have had associations with priestly families and could have had admittance there. It could have been Nicodemus. I mean, I don't know who it was. We don't know who it was. It's not, his identity isn't given here. But whoever it was had Peter admitted also into the courtyard, so Peter could be nearby. Peter is brave enough to follow at a distance in order to see what Jesus, what is going to happen to Jesus. But he's not brave enough in the midst of that to say he's associated with Jesus. This is the whole idea. You see Peter that night, he's got his sword, he's ready to fight. I think when he's following Jesus and he's kind of at the door, he's going to be let in. He's maybe preparing himself, okay? I'm going to have a battle here. They might try to arrest me. I'll take out my sword. You know, he's mentally preparing himself for what's going to happen. He wasn't mentally preparing himself for a servant girl to say, aren't you one of his, I don't think you are, but maybe you are. He wasn't prepared for that kind of interrogation from a servant girl. And so he fails in that moment. He was ready for the significant test, the significant challenge, but not this kind. Her question was formed in a negative way. She was assuming he wasn't. It wasn't even a very positive accusation. And so it made it really easy for him, perhaps, to deny his association and thus gain entrance into the courtyard. But when one is not prepared to answer truthfully, one is always at risk of lying. I mean, if you don't make it your goal to answer truthfully all the time, then you will think in the moment, should I tell the truth? Or should I lie? That'll always be your problem, especially when you're afraid. Peter could probably even rationalize it to himself. He got through the door, right? Now he's inside. He's probably thinking, okay, well, I blew that one, but I'm here. I can help Jesus out. I still got my sword. I'll be here. I'll be ready. So one little small thing, I'm sure, is not a big deal. But the problem with his lie is that once he started down that path, it was going to be really, really, really hard for him to change that story. It's a cool night. Imagine everybody, they light the little fire, they're sitting around the fire. There's this guy standing over there in the shadows, right? Peter over there. It looks suspicious. Peter knows he's probably looking suspicious. They've already kind of hinted that maybe he's with Jesus. He's kind of cold. If he goes over to the fire, everything will be a little bit better for him, he's thinking. But once he's stated that he's not with Jesus, it would be much harder for him to remain separate from the world. He's already told them his position. So he's suspicious if he doesn't join them. So in order to look good in the eyes of everybody there, the second temptation, he moves over to the fire. And once Peter sought to fit in, he was forced to do what? To adopt the value system of the people around him. That is always what it will happen to you. You must choose who you want to be like. And those are the people who you spend time with and develop their value system. Value system is developed in a community. 1 Corinthians 15:33 says this, Do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. What's he saying? Your value system will be affected by who you hang out with. Well, that's a shocker, right? I hope not. You will adopt the value system of the company you choose to keep. If you find people who have a like value system to yours, you want to develop and keep in that value system, you have to keep company with them. You have to spend time with them. The people you spend time with are the people that you will adopt the value system of. If you don't spend time around godly people who want to be like Christ, you will get your value system from the other people you spend time with, or the culture, the movies, the books, the music. If you don't get it from sources that are seeking to be like Christ, you will get it from others. Verse 25. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, so they said to him, "You also are not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, asked, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?" Peter again denied it, and at once the rooster crowed. Peter's surrounded by people who are likely conjecturing about him. If we read the different testimonies in the gospel, we have different people asking him and questioning him. It's not the same list of just three people. So I'm imagining around the fire, the servant girl says, "Yeah, this guy looks familiar." And the other person said, "Yeah, my buddy got his ear cut off, you know, the guy's got a sword." You know, they're chatting around. Can you imagine how Peter's feeling? Very, very red-faced. But you can't tell from the glow of the fire. He's probably very happy about that. And with the third denial of being with Christ comes the crow of the rooster. And then Peter, of course, you know, no matter how much he wants to tell himself that it's just a small thing. He can't forget Christ's words. The prophecy that he would deny Jesus three times before the rooster crowed. And now there's no undoing what he's already done. But there also, for his sake, is the foreknowledge of Christ knowing this event. Jesus told him, "I know what's going to happen, and it's not going to change how I feel about you. There will be forgiveness." Verse 28. Then they led Jesus to the house of Caiaphas, from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early in the morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered them, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." The Jews said to him, "It's not lawful for us to put anyone to death." This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. John has passed over the accounts of Jesus before the Jews. He's there's nothing here about the trial before the Jews. But he's moved it right on to Pilate. Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea. And again, we see the Jews here. They're keeping their traditions, but not the law. Their tradition said, if we go into the house of Gentiles, we will become defiled. They were not be defiled by breathing air in a Gentile's house. Right? They were so afraid they might touch something or become defiled if they were in a Gentile's house, and then they wouldn't be able to keep the Passover. But they were breaking the law, because the law said, thou shalt not murder. And that's exactly what they were doing. They were legally trying to do a murder. Pilate asked them the formal charge against Jesus. He's like, okay, so what's the charge? And notice they don't say what it is. Well, if he wasn't a wrongdoer, we wouldn't ask to have him killed. You know, it's not a very good reason. He wants them to declare why he should put somebody to death. And the Jews don't have a reason, at least not one that they know is going to work in a Roman court. They might have a reason they can get away with in their judicial system, blasphemy, but they have nothing that the Romans are going to see as worthy of death. So they're saying to Pilate, just trust us on this one. Can you imagine wanting somebody to put to death by the authorities and say, just trust me, I know what I'm doing. And that's exactly what they're doing. And Pilate is too smart to fall for that. So he says, you deal with it yourselves. But the Jews have one thing in mind. They want Jesus crucified. They want him to die on a cross. And that's very important. God wants him to die on a cross too, but obviously for very different reasons. And Jesus has already said he's going to die on a cross. He's not going to die by stoning or anything else. He is going to die on a cross. The Jews wanted Jesus crucified because they could point to the law and said, cursed is anyone who's hung on a tree. They wanted that. They wanted that so badly. And that's why they want the Romans to hang him on a tree. But that was God's point all along, that Jesus would be rejected by men and crucified. He would be cursed in our place to remove the curse and condemnation that the law had against us. Jesus would die on the cross as a sacrifice. He would willingly die there, giving himself for us. Verse 33, so Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me? Jesus answered, Pilate answered, am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world. Then Pilate said to him, so you are a king. Jesus answered, you say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. Should you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? They cried out again, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. Are you the king of the Jews? That's what Pilate asked Jesus. Are you the king of the Jews? Very interesting question. Obviously, he's got this, we know from the other Gospels, from the Jews. This is their accusation against him. They figure Pilate will kill him as a person who's trying to form an insurrection against the Romans. Obviously, the fact that the Jews brought this charge is left out of John's thing here. So Pilate can immediately see the man before him is not acting like a revolutionary. You know, normally a revolutionary does what? You know, he either is going to scream against the authority, or he's going to fight, or he's going to, you know, you could just imagine somebody in there, in the presence of Pilate, yelling and screaming his position. And Jesus isn't doing that at all. He's just standing there very matter-of-factly. So Jesus says to him, are you asking me this question on your own, or did somebody else put you up to it? You know, in other words, the Jews. What's the difference? If Pilate is asking the question himself, then it's a Roman political question. If Pilate's really wondering that, then it is a question of, is Jesus trying to overthrow Roman rule in the territory of Judea. But if Pilate is asking the question because the Jews are putting him up to it, which is exactly what was happening, then it was a question of whether or not Jesus was the Messiah. A very different question. So Jesus can't answer yes or no until he knows the nature of the question. Because if the question is, from a Roman standpoint, are you trying to overthrow the Romans and establish a kingdom? The answer is no. But if the question is, are you the Messiah of the Jews? The answer is yes. So the question isn't formed properly yet. So Pilate says to Jesus, am I a Jew? I mean, what do you think? I mean, think I'm asking you Jewish questions here? He didn't arrest Jesus on his own, and he says, it's not a Roman matter. It's these Jews, they brought you in here, so what did you do to them? Pilate's mystified right now. The Jews want this man killed right now, today, during the Passover. Very unusual. Not only that, they want it done by the Romans. Very unusual. And they won't give a good reason. Very unusual. So Pilate is curious to know why they want to do this to Jesus. What has he done that has offended them so badly? And of course, Jesus answers, my kingdom is not of the world. You've heard me say that so many times. Jesus' kingdom is not an earthly kingdom, right? Here it is. Don't let people deceive you. Jesus' kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. He said it himself. Jesus' kingdom is not of this world when he was crucified, and it's still not an earthly kingdom. Jesus never wanted his disciples to fight to save him or establish an earthly kingdom, and he has never changed his mind on that. Note another thing here. If the kingdom was earthly, the disciples would have fought to keep Jesus from being handed over to the Jews, not the Romans. That's kind of an interesting thing. To the Jews. This shows that the charge against him, being king of the Jews, doesn't make any sense in any light. If he was after an earthly kingdom of Jews, he wouldn't have the Jews fight against the Jews to establish a kingdom of the Jews. It just was baffling. So the Jews truly were rejecting their Messiah. But it shows another thing too, that the kingdom of Jesus is not a Jewish kingdom. That's very significant. Jesus' kingdom is not just an earthly kingdom, it's also not a Jewish kingdom. It's a kingdom for all people, anyone who enters it, Jew or Gentile. Jesus is a king, and he has a kingdom, but it's not of this world. It does not fight to establish itself or protect itself as an earthly kingdom does. So Pilate says to him, so you are a king. You got a kingdom, you have to be a king, right? Note that Jesus doesn't say he is a king. He just says he has a kingdom. And so Jesus said to him, well, those are your words. This is the essence of the Greek. Well, those are your words, not mine. I'm not using those words myself here. These are your words, but they're accurate. Then Jesus says he came to bear witness to the truth. His mission, in other words, is to call out all the people who desire truth. Those who are of the truth will hear the truth. They will accept the truth of Jesus' words. Jesus speaks here to Pilate, then of his pre-existence before his birth into the world. I have come into the world for this very purpose. Pilate is going to notice that it's very unusual for a person to say words like that. Pilate's response to Jesus being the bearer of the truth of God is, what is truth? Now, we don't know his attitude, and so those words, what is truth, could be said in so many different ways. It could be sarcastically, philosophically, wistfully. I mean, there's so many ways to say it. Ultimately, it doesn't matter how he said it, his reaction is, I'm not interested. I'm not interested. This is Pilate's big moment in life. Here he is, he has Jesus standing before him. He can ask him anything he wants. Jesus said, let's talk about truth. And Pilate said, I'm not interested. That was his moment to be transformed. He had made up his mind. Jesus was not guilty of these charges that the Jews were throwing at him. So he went out and spoke to the Jews again. Whom should I release? The king of the Jews? So the interesting thing, he says Jesus is not guilty, and then he offers to release him. You know, a person that's not guilty should be allowed to go free, right? Automatically. That's not what happened. Pilate is trying to walk the line here. He's treating him as a criminal who needs to be released, while at the same time pronouncing him not guilty. He's thinking, I'm pretty clever. He didn't realize it was going to backfire on him. Because he wasn't expecting the crowd out to there to begin to ask to release Barabbas. Now, I've told you before on another occasion, because John leaves us out here, Barabbas is a notorious criminal. He's an insurrectionist. He is exactly the kind of guy that the Romans want to crucify. He is everything that the Jews are accusing Jesus of being. He's a bad guy, a murderer. And he's got his followers who are standing out in the courtyard, knowing that the tradition is to release somebody. They're ready. They're wanting to release Barabbas. Nobody knows Jesus got arrested. A few people know, and they're not present. And so the Jews who are present, the chief priests, very easy for call for Barabbas' release. The name Barabbas means son of the father. That's what he called himself. It wasn't his real name. Son of the Father. They're going to kill the real son of the Father and release Barabbas. Again, it goes to what Jesus said before. They hated me without cause. They reject everything about who Jesus is. Everything they accuse him of being, they release in the person of Barabbas. But Jesus knew all this. No matter how you feel about the crucifixion, I mean, you can look at it and you can know that he was unjustly treated, but it was still the plan of God. It's what he wanted done. As we said before, the cross is the place of glory. It's glorious to us. Unjustice, yes, but it wasn't just the injustice of the people that crucified him. When Jesus dies on the cross and is punished by the Father, he's not punished for his own sin. He's, in one sense, unjustly treated for your sin and my sin. But he did that for a reason, that we might come into the family of God, have all our sins taken away, be completely forgiven forever, enter into his kingdom, and adopt his value system. That's why it's called good news. We're going to have communion this morning. Can I have Wayne? Larry, could you come up? So you guys know what this is all about, right? This is all about how we're to treat one another. That's what it's about. You know what it's like to be unjustly treated. How much do you like that? You hate it. You hate being unjustly treated. Even if it's not true. If you just think you've been unjustly treated. Jesus was unjustly treated. Why? For our sake, he was treated unjustly for our sake. So when we think about the cup is how Jesus was treated unjustly for our sake. The bread means what to us? One body, we're one body. It means when somebody in the body treats you unjustly, or you think they've treated you unjustly, how are you to respond to them? The same way that God treats you. The same way. Forgiving. Forgiving one another. I'm trying to get my kids to understand this whole concept. I just had a birthday last week, right? And so what happens on my birthday? Everybody treats me extra special. They always treat me special, but they treat me extra special on my birthday. I'm trying to think, what does it mean, or how can you convey to little kids how you treat one another preferably or with honor, as it says in the book of Romans, treating one another better than yourselves? I said to him, supposed to treat each other every day like it's everybody else's birthday. That's what it's like. Without the gifts, right? But you treat them that way. Because on a person's special day, you know, you let a few things slide extra. You're a little more giving to them. You want them, you share a little bit more with them. You're supposed to do that every day. Not just in your homes, but also within the body. That's how we're supposed to treat each other every day. And so when you think somebody offends you, we're supposed to remember, that's what this whole thing is about. The bread and the wine are all about, you know, if I feel like I've been offended, I forgive it. But I'm supposed to go out of my way to treat others. The Bible doesn't say, like it's their birthday. I'm trying to use that to convey to you what it means to treat other people in a special way every day. So let's take the bread together. if you've taken that bread, that's your promise to this community, that you act in one with this community. That's what it's about. Every month when we take it. If you're not willing to act like you're part of this community, don't take the bread. That's what it means. It means don't take the bread. If you don't want to be forgiving to one another, if you don't want to act like one with one another, don't take the bread. It's a promise. It's the same thing when you take the cup. You're remembering what God has done for you. It's your unity with Christ. If you don't want unity with Christ, don't take the cup. Nothing magical about it, but it's like a promise on our half, because it's a covenant. It's our wanting to be participants, there we go, in the covenant that God makes with us. And that's what it's like. Let's take it together. Father, we thank you that you loved us so much, that you were willing to treat your Son unjustly so that we could be treated with great loving forgiveness. Help us to remember that in our homes, in our families, and within this body. We are to treat each other in a great way every single day. Have positive thoughts, positive treatments for everyone. Help us to remember this, that we could be like you, reaching out even when we think we're being treated unjustly, for the sake of others and for the sake of your kingdom. Amen.